Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Art of Selling podcast. Now, on the show, we mainly talk about the best kept secrets when it comes to selling more stuff to more people. And we wish that this information was around when we started. It wasn't, so we invested close to R1 million over the last couple of years, learning and working with some of the best sales gurus, marketing experts, and business coaches. And now we're sharing a lot of this information for free because hopefully you don't have to struggle as much as we do. Now, what's the catch? Well, the catch is just leave your ego at the door, open your mind, and practice some of these perspectives when it comes to your business. Now, my name is Yanu De Beer. I'm the host. And today, joining me are co-hosts Gilbert Kumpukwe and Vikas van Wyk. Gilbert, how's it? How are you?
I'm fantastic, my brother. Good to be on the show again. I'm excited for today's podcast, and I hope a lot of people get a lot of value out of it.
Yeah, likewise. I think there's a lot of valuable stuff that we're going to unpack in this episode, and I can't wait to get started.
Yeah, so on the show, all the episodes, we basically focus on speaking about all the psychological elements that come into play when it comes to your marketing and your sales strategies, because that's really what makes the biggest difference when it comes to your success. Now, in the previous episode, if you haven't watched that, I think it's a great foundational episode to watch or to listen to. I would start there if you are joining us fresh. You know, we talk about literally the psychological element that comes into play when it comes to your marketing and sales strategies. And that is literally the biggest element that can contribute to your success. So we spoke about technology and psychology. Those are really the two pillars that contributes to a successful marketing and sales strategy. Now, a lot of companies depend purely on the technology side, and they completely neglect the psychological aspects of a successful strategy. And we highlighted that the psychological element is about, you know, 80 to 85% of the equation. And that's what a lot of people tend to forget or neglect. So on the show, we talk about all the best kept secrets when it comes to sales, and we hope that you enjoy it. Now, on today's show, we're going to speak and talk about the emotional and cognitive biases. So in short, really just understanding how the brain makes decisions according to its logical reasoning process and emotional decision-making process. And that is what we're going to be discussing today. Those are literally the two ways that the brain makes decisions when it comes to determining whether a product or a service is a fit for, you know, itself. And the better we understand that, the better we can position our messaging and our marketing in order to influence the decision-making process.
Underpinning all of that, I just want to emphasize this because I do think it's important. Underlying everything comes down to the system one and understanding the system one and system two of how your brain works. This was written by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. And I'm simplifying it, but basically all it means is system one is the automatic, impulsive responder to things, messages that it receives. And then system two is the logical aspect of it, where it starts to calculate the decisions based off of what the next action that it wants to take. So your system one is very automatic. It's impulsive. It just responds quickly without really thinking about it. But your system two then kicks in to reason out what system one wants to do.
100%. So your emotional and cognitive biases, essentially logical and emotional reasoning. You know, these things are so crucial to understand when it comes to our marketing and sales processes. So maybe let's just start by explaining what biases really are. So we're talking about emotional and cognitive biases. Maybe there are some people who are not 100% sure what biases are. Whether you know or don't know, I think let's just cover the topic of what actually a bias is. And I mean, the easiest way to really explain it would be to imagine that you have maybe your best friend running in a race. You know that they're not the fastest, but you are rooting for them and you really hoping that they win because you have an emotional attachment, you know, to them essentially. And you are now biased to them winning because you want your best friend to win, even though there might be faster people running or entering the race. That becomes a form of bias. And we get different types of biases. Like I said earlier, we've got cognitive biases, emotional biases. So I would love to start to maybe just unpack all the different emotional biases. And there are a ton of them. So we're maybe just going to unpack some of the most important ones. Otherwise, we might be here all day. So we want to unpack some of the most important emotional cognitive biases that come into play when a consumer starts to make a decision whether your product or service is worth investing in. So the first thing we want to unpack maybe just is your emotional biases. And Yeah, Vix, I mean, I don't know if you want to quickly run us down on what you see in emotional biases, and we can maybe unpack some examples of that as well.
So to me, an emotional bias is pretty much, if we refer back to the race, you naturally want to favor your friend because you have an emotional connection with them. And that obscures your judgment in a way because you have an emotional connection with your friend. And because of that, you don't weigh the realistic outcome of the race, meaning there might be somebody that's faster than him or something in those lines. And essentially, that obscures your judgment at the end of the day of making the logical right decision.
Yeah, essentially, they are faster people in the race. Mm. So logically, the fastest person is going to win. But essentially, you are emotionally attached to your friend. So you're kind of like, hey,
yeah,
go for it.
I think it's a fallacy of truth, basically, where you believe that that emotional attachment, that decision that you are making is truth purely because of your connection emotionally as opposed to logically and actually calculating things and the outcomes. One of the things that it also reminds me of is authority bias, right? And authority bias is basically the bias towards seeing, for example, someone in a authoritative figure or shape. So they say if there is a product that's possibly being promoted, especially this usually happens in medicine and healthcare, when you see an individual with a white coat on, you and they're promoting something, you automatically trust and have and believe that that product is good for you because you're associating that white coat with a doctor. Mm. And so because the doctor has authority, given their degree, their stature, their skills, their knowledge, you associate that with then trusting whatever it is that they're promoting because the authority automatically gives that product credibility just by simply putting on a white coat and looking like a doctor, right? And that's the thing. It doesn't necessarily mean it's always truth, right? But however, it's purely because our minds are tricked into thinking that this is a person with a degree, they've got a possibly a credibility, and therefore you choose them as truth over any other evidence against it.
Therefore, well, it overrides the logical side of your brain in a way.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that really what influencer marketing is?
Mm-hmm. So, exactly, right? Going down that route.
Yeah. So essentially, like, influencer marketing is a form of emotional bias because if there's someone that you're following on Instagram that you admire and that person's telling you, let's take the health and weight loss space, for example. So if you're following someone who's quite inspirational, trains every day, has got a healthy body, you know, if you're a female, maybe she's got a kid or two and you resonate with that because you've got kids and she's obviously someone that you look up to. If she explained to you that these are the products that she uses in order to remain in shape and to remain healthy, then there's an emotional connection to that. And that emotional connection, like you referenced, is like from an authority standpoint, like she's now seen as an authoritative figure and an influential figure. And because you emotionally attached to her, you're starting to believe that credibility that is technically potentially false. We don't know if it's true or not. So all logical reasoning kind of like goes out the window and you're like, well, she uses it. So, and I like her. So let me just buy it and see what happens.
I think what's important actually as well, underlying this conversation is we're talking a lot about emotion. I don't remember what the exact stat is. It's like, I don't know, 80% of the decisions we make are based off of emotion.
True.
And that speaks to obviously a broader topic around, okay, when it comes to your marketing, when it comes to the selling, what are you speaking to? Are you speaking to the logical side of the brain or are you speaking to the emotional side of the brain? Because most of the time, it's the emotional side that gets its way. Up until, of course, the logical side kicks in. And even when that happens, you need to be ready for those objections. And that's what we chatted about in the last podcast, right? So it's understanding that what is driving the consumer, what is driving the people is the emotional side of it. And you need to be able to tap into that aspect. And that's why we're obviously unpacking all the biases so that you can understand the different dynamics that exist and be able to communicate and market in the most effective way to get your point across and get the action that you ultimately would love the consumer to take.
Yeah, so 100%. Like, it's really just understanding that let's say 70-80% of our decisions are usually emotional. And there's this logical gatekeeper that we spoke about in the previous episode that comes to the surface and goes, hey, wait a second. Before you open that wallet, do you really need this right now?
System two.
Exactly. So the cognitive side, you know, gets activated, and the more logical reasoning side gets activated. And as a business, you know, your goal would be to handle potentially those logical reasoning or those objections. And if you can do that, you're going to have a higher probability of selling more product and services. Yeah. Now, there are many, many examples. And I think because most of the decisions that we make are emotional, we want to, you know, maybe start with all the emotional examples that we can obviously reference in today's show. But I think it's also important to understand that not every single person is the same. Some people are potentially more logical driven. Like some people who are extremely analytical, you get people who are very analytical, and they've almost naturally suppressed the emotional side because they're not emotional human beings. Like most of us are. But essentially, to a degree, some people are less emotional when it comes to their decision making, and they have a higher logical reasoning side. And that is why your marketing should always include both aspects. Your marketing can't just be an emotional message. It can't just be a logical message. You have to include both, because people have those systems. There are two systems in the brain, and both of them play a part in the decision-making process. And your messaging and your strategy should always include both, you know, of those elements. So when you're handling those objections, so from an emotional standpoint, another big one is just scarcity and urgency. So that is an emotional bias. So because if it's Black Friday, for example, I mean, we can just chat about that. Like there is real, authentic scarcity. And that creates the emotion of losing or fearing the fact that you might miss out on a really good deal. Because you are emotionally attached to the outcome of having that big screen, 50-inch, 60-inch, 70-inch TV. That's now 30, 40% off or 50% off. So because you're emotionally attached to the expectation of having that TV, and Black Friday comes along and you have 24 hours to act, or you have to be the first one there, there's this emotional part of your mind that goes, I need to get there because otherwise I'm going to miss out on this. And the pain of not having that and losing out on that is real, essentially. So, I mean, scarcity and urgency, but also we can talk about the fact that scarcity and urgency is not the same thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from my understanding, and you're happy to chime in, like scarcity, we need to understand is when you have, in essence, a limited amount of stock left. I mean, you can look at it as like scarcity is like, listen, there's only so much left, and urgency is like, this deal is going to end. So urgency has got more of a time element attached to it, where scarcity has got more of a, you know, a tangible element attached to it in terms of how much is actually available, how much is actually, what is the demand versus the supply. So in my mind, scarcity is more of a tangible thing where the demand outweighs the amount of product that's in the market. So therefore, there's a rarity and a scarcity attached to it. And then urgency has got more of a time element attached to it, like it's Black Friday. But Black Friday has got both.
Mm-hmm. And it can have both. Yeah. That's the thing. So you can, what's that expression? Kill two birds with one stone at the end of the day. But you are right. You're spot on. I mean, you've explained it really well. I don't want to add any more, but I've got a feeling Vickers can add a lot of insights because he has a very good understanding of these concepts. I don't know. Maybe you have an example of how it would work in a marketing setting.
Yeah, I think we don't necessarily run any ads without urgency and scarcity, purely because it's such a powerful way to get people into action. After you've created, or after you've positioned your offer in the market, after you have really kind of broken down some of the objections within your advertising, urgency and scarcity is really the only best way to get people into the next stage of the sales process. And it's an essential part, fundamental part of any marketing campaign, essentially.
I think what's important then, and this needs to be added on what you said, is that it needs to be true and authentic scarcity and urgency too. For sure. So I think what's happening right now in the world that we live in is that there's a lot of fake urgency and scarcity, and people are starting to see straight through that BS.
So that actually damages your authority, and that it actually does the campaign more bad than it does good.
100%. So it's understanding that if you're going to be using this tactic, and obviously as marketers, we ruin everything. So, you know, we learned back in the 1930s that scarcity and urgency is a real thing, and that, you know, it can desperately help a business that's struggling in some way, shape, or form. And then as marketers, we started, you know, piggybacking off on that tactic to the point where we've kind of like ruined it completely, where people can start to see, because we're moving into an era where marketing is becoming a lot more transparent. And, you know, because of social media and the technical advances and the way we consume information and the digital realm, essentially, like, we've become a lot more transparent. Like, you know, brands are more open to how they're creating their products. Brands are more open to what's happening behind the scenes. And because of that, we can start to smell BS as a consumer. The consumers can smell BS. And if your urgency and your scarcity doesn't have authenticity attached to it, if it's not real, people pick that up. So I think a lot of dropshipping stores do this exceptionally well, and we can talk about that all day, Gil.
No, we can. And I think, touching on that point, it's also having an understanding that, yes, these are strategies that one can employ, because we know that, you know, their biases and their fallacies and all cognitive thinking. But you can't have a store that is saying, you know, 5 in stock for the last 3 months. at some point, they're going to pick up and say, this has been 5 in stock for the last 3 months. They're BSing me. And I think it goes to a deeper level of how now the consumer is perceiving your brand. You're talking about transparency and how, you know, marketing, we need to be as transparent as possible. But your brand's reputation, like you've highlighted, is at stake, because at the end of the day, the moment they can smell BS, they will go on social media and say something about it. And if they're not happy with you as a brand and they don't feel like you're authentic, because we must remember, people invest in brands. They're followers, they're advocates of brands. And they can do the complete opposite, 360 on you, if they feel like you are not a legitimate, you are not an authentic, you are not an original brand. And when you are especially marketing on social media platforms, you must understand by default, you're exposing yourself to the world outside of potentially your control. So on the one end, yes, these are marketing strategies that one can employ. But on the other end, you've got to understand that with power comes responsibility. And you're under microscope from people, from brands or brand advocates or supporters of your brand that can put your business, on the one end in a good position, on the other end in a very bad position. So before you consider, let's just create urgency, let's just say that there's only 10 in stock, you must also think of the ripple effects if you are not being truthful and authentic about it.
I think that's why Black Friday is so powerful, because everybody knows that's the day and then people discount. Yes. And because people discount, everybody's rushing to the store to get that discount. And because they're rushing to the store to get that discount, there's going to be few or little stock left, and they are essentially going to run out. And if I think of Black Friday, like, it ticks all the boxes of urgency, scarcity, and it being authentic as well. But then on the flip side, people increase their prices before Black Friday, and then at the same time, you know, put it back, you know, making individuals think that they're getting the best deal of their lives when they're not. And people are also starting to pick up on that. Mm-hmm. So reflecting on what we just said, like, Black Friday is a classic example of both being authentic and also not being as authentic anymore, because we started ruining the actual efficacy of it by overdoing it and being fake about it.
Yeah, it's so important to have a really good reason why there's urgency and scarcity behind your product, because it can almost come across to the consumer like it's some form of manipulation instead of influencing them to buy something. And that's why it's so important to have really legit and some urgency and scarcity that actually makes sense in the context of your business and to the consumer as well.
Yeah, it's so true. So I think another example that I thought of was just, you know, it's basically people are more emotionally inclined to protect themselves from losing something than to actually gaining something. Do you want to say something?
Is that the philosopher version, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they say it pains us more. You know, the experience of the loss is much more painful and impactful than the opposite, which is gaining something.
Yeah, like the emotional feeling behind it we get. They said almost like it's almost like twice as the intensity of the feeling of losing something is also almost twice as powerful as gaining something. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you're alluding to.
Yeah, it's like I had a chat with a multimillionaire years back. And this conversation resonates because he said, Yandre, everybody, if you have nothing, your first goal is to get something. But then he says, a lot of people, because we were reflecting on stress and anxiety and how people that have, because we assume that if your finances are ticked and you've ticked the financial boxes, there's not really much stress and anxiety to go around. Like, I mean, if you've ticked those boxes and you're financially stable as a human being, then what else is there to stress about it, as long as everybody in your life is healthy? And it's like, when are you truly happy? We had like an interesting conversation because he was quite successful and he was really stressed out and anxious. And it came down to him telling me his feedback or interpretation or perspective on life. And he was saying, Yandre, when you have nothing, your first goal is to get something. Then when you get something, you want to get more. And then essentially you realize you don't need more. But what happens is then you're trying to protect all of it. So it's like when you have enough, your biggest goal is to protect it the whole time. And that creates a stress and anxiety. Mm-hmm. So it's like the people that are, for example, like really wealthy, they're constantly stressed and anxious about protecting their wealth because they don't want to lose it. So the uncertainty of tomorrow creates the stress and anxiety that they face because they're scared of losing what they've worked so hard to gain. So that now becomes, they become depressed. And, you know, a lot of these individuals, obviously there's many different factors to why this might happen, but it was an interesting conversation and it's very applicable to what we're saying now. It's like that pain of losing is, you know, almost double the intensity of gaining something. And as a company, you can strategically use that to your advantage by offering, for example, like a free trial where someone is like, look, at the same time, I don't want to miss out on this deal, but then emotionally, I also don't want to have buyer's regret at the same time by making this financial commitment. So reflecting on loss aversion and the scarcity element of what we've discussed, you know, a simple tactic that we use for certain products and a lot of other companies and brands use is like, hey, try this for free. Or here's a guarantee if you don't like what you see. Or here's a guarantee if you don't get the result that you want or whatever it is. And that essentially can then emotionally bypass that feeling of, one, I want to make a decision, but I'm scared of losing out. And if I get it, I'm scared of losing it. And essentially like a free trial or like essentially giving someone a money back or removing that risk of losing it essentially can help us. And that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. In essence, like free trials are good, but like I'm always afraid that when you do free trials that you kind of like can attract the wrong crowd and you might run the risk of wasting your time and everybody else's time. So like I think the risk reverse option of giving them a guarantee or money back is a lot better.
Well, you're speaking from a perspective of a service business.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So I think it's important to give that context because there are a lot of software companies out there that might completely disagree with what you're saying now.
No, for sure.
I think from a marketing side of it as well, in terms of, you know, getting the message across. So one of the things that maybe some have even seen is we're talking about this aspect of losing and the impact that has on an individual. And you can imagine if, you know, there's a product out there that is meant to help promote health, your physical, mental health. And here you are, an individual who has life right now, but is constantly engaging in, you know, drugs or alcohol abuse or smoking. And you've got a solution to help someone live a much healthier life, then what you might see in the marketing messages is focusing on the loss side of things, meaning you could lose 10 years of your life by picking up that cigarette and making one pull. And that's the type of messaging that you start getting. You know, you end up losing 5 years of your life by having to bring up a drink and down a bottle of whiskey every night or whatever the case may be. And it goes so much deep into, if you have a family, what could you could potentially find yourself in a position where you lose it all. You could find yourself in a position where you're no longer able to provide because you're not healthy anymore, purely because you're engaging in certain activities. And so what ends up happening is that you start seeing marketing messages that focus on the loss based off of the actions and the lifestyle you're choosing to live. And those aspects are very close to you, such as your family, your livelihood, and all the stuff that you've worked for.
Yeah, I mean, that's why insurance companies are really so successful.
Yeah.
And they literally piggyback on the emotion of fear and the loss aversion. Like if you get a new, you know, phone, I mean, back in the day, there was no insurance for phones. Now people are like, oh, I don't want to crack my screen. Now I don't want to do this. I don't want to lose my phone. We live obviously in South Africa. There's a high probability of my phone getting stolen. So I'd rather get it insured. And even when, you know, if you look at it mathematically, let's say, for example, you live somewhere where there's very little crime, like some old small little town in the Western Cape, you know, some off the grid, 5,000 people only. There's a lady there that's most likely being told that you do need this insurance because what if your phone is being stolen? And she could logically make the decision going, well, you know what, the odds of my phone getting stolen and where I'm living and the fact that there hasn't been any crime in this town for the last, you know, how many years, whatever. She's sitting there going, logically, she can think, you know what? I probably don't need this. But emotionally, the person on the other side is like, look, we live in South Africa. The crime rates, right? You never know when your phone's going to be. Maybe you're going up to Cape Town or maybe you go to Joburg to visit your daughter at the airport. They do smash and grabs and all these things all the time. Yeah, you know what? Let me just get it.
Let me get that insurance.
I need that insurance. And obviously, you know, it is sometimes very wise to get these things, but obviously there's a balancing effect and there's obviously a logical reasoning side that can kick in. But this is, you know, we're talking about emotional biases and the loss aversion side. And I think that's why insurance companies are so successful at the same time.
The fear factor.
I think the other thing I want to touch on when we talk about loss aversion is there's a lot of scams out there in terms of you don't necessarily know what websites and what companies you can trust online. And from a service perspective as well. I've heard so many stories of people paying for services and never getting it. Or I was looking, the other day I was looking for a new stand for my phone to record videos on. And there was multiple sites and there's something specific that I was looking for. And every time I went and Googled the site, it looked legit from the face of it. But every time I went into reviews and Googled the company itself and say, just simply Googling something like, is this X company legit? And people would leave reviews of how they got scammed by this company. I think that's also a big thing or be a big fear factor for people to not buy something.
Well, that's why we have the risk removal in place, right? That's why we, as a you know, as a marketer and as a sales person and individually, if you want to grow your business, you need to understand that these objections are going to be there. Like people, if you're in an industry, for example, you know, maybe if you have an online store and your online store is quite new, then you need to understand that people are going to come to your store and not see a ton of reviews. They're not going to see that other people have bought this product. And that will create the perception that this might not be a legitimate business because there are so many scam artists out there that are selling product that people never receive. So if you do have an online store and if you start out an online store, these are the things that you obviously need to take into consideration because these emotional biases of your consumers are most likely what is preventing them from making a decision of buying from your store because you haven't ticked those boxes that can handle those objections.
Yep. There's I believe it's called the bandwagon effect. And the bandwagon effect is the aspect of going and seeing product reviews, for example, seeing a ton of them, 5 stars, 150 five-star reviews, and looking on social media and they've got, you know, 5 stars as well there and 100 reviews, positive ones. And purely by seeing all those positive reviews, the mind automatically says, yes, that's a good thing. Get that because there's positive reviews and there's proof that there's a lot of people who are happy with it. Therefore, I'm going to make that decision. You don't really think about it again logically. it's purely because you're seeing other people giving praise, you are bandwagoning, you're on that wagon with the band, and then that actually is what causes that decision to buy. Like, ah, everybody else is liking this, I'm going to like it too. Therefore, it reinforces that decision to say that's a good decision. Yeah. And that's the aspect of the bandwagon effect as well. It kicks in.
If I can take Alex Hormozi's words, he says, you need to have an undeniable stack of proof that your company is who they say they are. You are.
100%. I think touching on, you know, the bandwagon effect and the fact that a lot of reviews gets the mind to immediately trust the company that's selling the product, we need to understand that the bandwagon effect, you know, the name, whatever we want to call it, is really a cognitive bias. Because a cognitive bias, and, you know, we can quickly maybe explain this, is that it's almost like tricking the brain into thinking it's making a logical decision. So it's, even though you've got this logical part of your mind that's helping you make a decision, it's getting almost like a little bit of a shortcut, feeding the mind information that gets it to go, this makes logically sense. So in that case, like, it is emotional. You're not thinking logically, but you're trying to, but you can't, because you think that you're thinking logically, right? I mean, essentially, that's what a cognitive bias is. Like, it's almost like this, it's you're thinking logically about it, but all the proof is there that this makes logically sense. Because if everybody is bought it and everybody's liking it and enjoying it, then it makes logical sense that I'm most likely are going to enjoy it too.
Underpinning that, it's exactly what you're saying. These biases are shortcuts, because system two does not like to be engaged. System two requires brain activity. It requires you to think. It takes a lot of energy out of your mind. And ultimately, by default, that's why system one is so prevalent, because it's the shortcuts that it responds to in order to make decisions. Also, I think maybe at a deeper level, it's probably this way because of how we've, through evolution, in terms of survival, right? Yeah, you'd go out there and you're hunting for game when we're back in them, those ages. You couldn't always, in order for you to survive, you always have to make quick decisions and impulsive decisions. You hear something, you're like, oh, that's probably danger. I got to go. I got to split, right? But you can't sit there and try and calculate now. You heard something, you're like, okay, wait, could that be, maybe it's not what I think it is. Let me calculate and see. By the time you're trying to calculate if it's real danger or not, that animal's already coming at you and your life is in danger. So you need to understand where it really all came from. It's because of the survival mechanism that we, over time, it was through evolution. The shortcuts are what allow us to live our lives in a more succinct manner and be able to make decisions accordingly. And when you understand that the biases are there, to actually were there technically to for survival mode, we still, it's all embedded in us regardless, even throughout these ages and today, because it allows us just to move forward in life and make decisions, as opposed to sitting around, you know, sticking it through and trying to still process things. We'll never make decisions at the end of the day. But as a fallacy as it is, or as a tricks the brain, it also helps us to actually get decisions out there and make decisions and move forward with life.
Yeah, like our brain steers us away from pain and towards pleasure. That's also one example.
Hundreds. So it's really understanding that if we as marketers and sales, individuals or businesses better understand how the brain operates, this is why this podcast exists, the better we can portray a specific message that allows the consumer's mind to just make a decision on the spot about the product or service, and hopefully in favor of the business. But at the same time, you know, we've spoken about the fact that your product should obviously then add that value. And, based on the previous episode we had, we spoke about how Apple gets that right. And essentially, I think the example that I wanted to use was almost like it's called confirmation bias. And in essence, what it boils down to is, because other people talk highly of the brand, and because, you know, maybe you've had one good experience with that brand, if that brand had to launch a second product, you immediately confirming in your mind that that is worth trying, because why wouldn't it be good if people talk highly about the brand and you've had a taste of one of its products. And now there's a second product and your mind logically just goes, let me just try it. Like, I'm pretty sure this is going to help me too. And this worked really well with Apple's AirPods. Like, the AirPods was one of the first products that came out that revolutionized headsets. So Bluetooth headsets kind of existed, but the actual earpieces, you know, the individual earphones, technically, that didn't exist. So Apple had this undeniable stack of proof, as you know, mentioned earlier, that their iPhone is really awesome, that their MacBooks are really awesome. And then they launched this, you know, headset, or, you know, earphones, Bluetooth earphones. And it was just a massive, massive hit. It took the company, you know, to new levels of revenue, purely because of that exact thing that happened to its consumer base. Its customer base, like, its whole customer base had confirmation bias on that new product.
Yeah, like, that's also where your brand needs to be careful, because they can easily lose a lot of credibility with their customers, because now they've built a lot of trust and credibility in the one side of the business. And if they launch a crappy product, that might backfire completely on them. But Apple being who they are, they always obviously make sure that it's something that's going to be a hit based on their market research and whatnot. But
I've actually seen, back when I was still heavily involved in the supplement and sports nutrition industry, that a few brands were really well known for specific products and specific categories. And there was this one particular brand called Animal Pack. Animal was the brand name technically, and they had a product called Animal Pack. And it was this sachet with like 1,000 pills in the sachet, like, that you had to take on a daily basis. Over-exaggerating, obviously. But I think it was like 11 pills that you had to take or something. And it had omegas and vitamins and minerals and anything that you can think of that can optimize your body from a health perspective and muscle building perspective and recovery perspective. And they only had that one, and maybe two or three other products really, but all, you know, facilitating that specific benefit. And then years later, they launched a whey protein, and it just didn't do so well. So it's one of those where people compared the price to an existing protein in the market. They tried it. I think a lot of the loyal following tried it, but it never really took off the way that they wanted it to, because the product just wasn't necessarily that amazing. Now, I'm speaking from my own ignorant perspective on the market, and I'm not 100% sure that that is actually the case. But with that said, it reminded me of that specific situation. And it's like what you said, like, if you do bring out a second product, obviously you hoping that it would add as much value and benefit to the consumers the way the first initial couple of products did as well.
Yeah, confirmation bias can really help you boost that new product in the context that you've just explained. But as I said, there's something that you need to protect there as well.
100%. But yeah, there are so many biases that we can essentially unpack. So we've spoken about the emotional, and we're starting to touch on the cognitive side of things. Another example that I thought of was, it's called the anchoring bias, where people, you know, actually it's called price anchoring in a way. And it's quite interesting, because you would, for example, portray a t-shirt for $100. And let's, for argument's sake, say that the brand is not that well known, but it's a really cool shirt. The $100 price tag, you know, 1,000 rand price tag, whatever you want to, currency you want to use, the fact that it is so high immediately tells your mind essentially that it might be good quality shirt, because otherwise why would it cost so much? But then at the same time, if you had to discount that shirt, let's say for 3 days, you get 50% off. The people that would have seen the initial price tag of 1,000 rand, and if they had to see the second, you know, price at a discount for 3 days, they would have, you know, a higher probability of actually acting on that deal, because they now know what the original price is. That was the first price that they saw. And because it's the first price that they saw, that kind of like anchored their understanding of what this price of the product actually is. So there's nothing really else to compare it to. So that's the anchoring price. And by them discounting that, people are going, this must be a good deal, because the original price is 1,000 rand. Now it's only 700 or 600. And that is essentially the price anchoring. And I think a lot of food chains and brands.
Clothing brands. Ooh, love doing that, eh?
Hundreds. But even Starbucks. So
yeah.
Their coffees, if you think about how they sell coffees, the medium, whatever they call it, like grande or whatever these names these days, I don't know. But the medium coffee is essentially only a small percentage more expensive than the small. So you'd rather not buy the small because you feel like you're getting so much more value from the medium. So this is obviously how you can manipulate price anchoring, because it's like going, well, the medium is, or the small is, for example, $40. But now your medium is $50. But it's almost like double the size. So now immediately your brain is going, well, I'm getting more value by getting the medium. So this is how brands are starting to implement, or not starting, but they always have implemented price anchoring. And I think, you know, it's just lessons that we can learn essentially from these cognitive biases.
I think you see it most common in SaaS products and their pricing models and the page that they put up. They usually do exactly what you're saying. They'll have maybe three prices. And it's interesting. They always highlight the middle one the most. And they'll even write things like most popular. But if you compare it to maybe the one on the left, it's, you know, 10, 20% difference. Mm. But then it almost makes you still feel a bit stupid. Like, why would I pay? I get it. I'm going to pay 10, 20% less here, but look what I'm getting more of if I just took the most popular that's right in front of me. So SaaS products love to do that a lot, where they put the pricings right in front of you. They'll put like three, and then they'll highlight the main one they really want you to choose. And then they'll show you how exactly that difference is. And it's not huge. So you'll be silly to take the second grade one versus the first one that I actually want you to choose.
The one lower than they recommend you take is almost never useful at all. Exactly. So the thing is, like, that is like their base product, and it's clear that they want to push more sales on that particular one, and they just make it psychologically possible for themselves in that way as well.
Yeah,
HubSpot was really amazing at this. Essentially, you know, they had a free product, the CRM that's completely free. But then as you start to use the CRM, like, you, I don't know, I mean, we're digressing more into, you know, other tactics here, but I want to touch on this because the free version was great, but it had so many limited capabilities. You can't do automations, you can't do workflows, you have to do everything manually. There's no automated triggers that can fire. And eventually when you try the free product, you're like, well, let me just get this $49 plan now. And I mean, the pricing used to be very different back in the day, but I saw recently that the pricing was like $49 or whatever. I just looked at it and I was like, yeah, this is brilliant, because it's understanding that the most valuable, most popular offer is really the most popular one for a reason, because that's how they've kind of like engineered it to be the most popular one. You mentioned earlier that someone is looking at the price and they're like, well, if this is everybody, the one that everybody's taking, let me just get it.
Bandwagon.
bandwagon effect, but also something else that comes into play is the availability heuristic. It's like essentially like, you know, this is the information that's available to me right now. Let me just make a decision. Because when you need the software and you need to do something, you need to do it. Like, I find myself often in a situation where I'm like, now I need to get the software to, you know, do the specific task. The last thing I want to do is like Google like 10 different web pages and then start doing research on what product. And yeah, you can go to a couple of sites that can potentially tell you which one is going to be best, but most of them are going to be biased in their own way too. So when you look at the information that's available and you're going, well, this just makes sense, let me just take it. And that's literally the availability heuristic kind of like cognitive bias, is like, the information is available, makes sense, let me just go with it now. And then they have the free trial that is like, well, there's lots of versions. Like, if I don't like it, like, it's at the end of the day, like, it is what it is. Let me, you know, this is like, we can start to see how all of these things are applicable in our daily lives based on, you know, how we're interacting with brands.
SaaS products. Sorry, but SaaS products are very good because they technically touching on so many different biases there that you've mentioned. You get heuristic, you get lots of version. You know, you get bandwagon, like literally all these biases all happening at once.
Yeah, it's all about perceived value, right? If you want to boil it down to one thing, the higher the perceived value to the consumer, the more likely they will take that option. And you do that by, as you said, like, people want to get the best deal at all times. And by positioning it in that way, with the SaaS products, by positioning it in the different columns and increasing the base product basically by 20%, that's how you create that effect at the end of the day to increase the perceived value of the product.
Yeah, and we spoke, you know, we touched on this earlier when, you know, someone maybe tells you, for example, if I'm looking to get software, I would usually ask someone who's potentially used software before, because it's either I don't want to do the research because it's like, let me just take what's in front of me, like this, whatever, this makes sense, let me just go with that. Or I'll ask you, someone else is like, hey, listen, what do we use for this? What is the best thing to use for that? And that's how we're starting to get influenced by other people's perspectives of a product, because now it's that situation where someone's giving you their interpretation of what they believe is the best option. And automatically it hacks your mind to go, well, if you say that's what it is, then I'm just going to give it a shot. It just makes sense. It saves me. Again, we spoke about in the previous episode about speed and convenience. Like, that is really what everything boils down to. So if Hubert was like, hey, you need to use this tool rather for that, then that's, I believe, it's going to be the best thing for me because I trust Gilbert.
Yep.
And that is essentially, you know, what we call the halo effect. So like I said earlier, we can start to see, the more we starting to unpack this, we can actually start to see, and you can probably, you're listening to this, you can go start to see, but hold on, I've seen this somewhere today. I've seen this somewhere this week. You're starting to connect the dots of how all these companies are technically leveraging all these little tactics in order to hack your mind. Now, I mean, it sounds like ridiculous, but that's literally what everybody's doing. They're trying to hack your attention. They're trying to hack your mind in order to get across the perceived value of a product so that you can make a decision on the spot as opposed to taking the time to think about it. We're all trying to bypass that logical gatekeeper that comes like that, almost like that traffic officer that goes, stop, wait, let's just... And that's constantly what brands are trying to do. And you sitting there as a business owner and as a, you know, whether you have a product in the market, you need to be cognizant of that, because if you just started a business, you need to understand that these tactics are crucial to you generating sales. Because if you're not going to do it, you have to compete with all these other companies that are constantly doing it all the time. So it's either like you start to adapt these psychological strategies and hacks in order when it comes to your marketing strategy, or you're going to have one freaking amazing product that nobody else has that people would just naturally gravitate to.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's not manipulation. I know, you know, you mentioned that the last time in the first podcast where we're not trying to manipulate you. We are trying to ensure, brands are trying to ensure and make sure that you fully understand the value, the product, the service that you are getting, because I do believe that it's also a disservice to anybody who is searching and seeking out a product if they don't have all the information. So when you are on a page, for example, that is showing you the product's features, benefits, versus other products, features, and benefits of other brands, they're not there to try and trick you because they have a lot of tick boxes, and the other aspect doesn't, and the other product doesn't have a lot of tick boxes. Of course, they won't name which the product is. But those comparisons there, again, it's about availability, having that information. And actually, they also do that. Some brands do that because they know that as a consumer, what do? We typically go and research, right? We're going to go and research if this is the best product, if this is the best service for me. So you know what I'm going to do? Instead of I giving you that work, I'm going to do the work for you. And I'm going to put everything black and white, as transparent as possible, so that you can see why this product that I am offering you is the best in the market. Also alluding to the confirmation or those ticks, it's ticking the boxes. And that's what really it's also boiling down to. It's making sure that companies are giving consumers all the available information to make an informed decision so that they can understand that they are indeed getting the best deal on the market.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, just concluding this episode, it's a matter of understanding that our thought processes, our brain, there's two systems that operate the brain, as you said in the beginning of the show, Gil. And we have the emotional side and the logical side. And if we can understand that as business owners and as marketers, we can essentially position information in a way that it makes it easier for the customer to get to a conclusion. And this is what we're saying. We're not trying to manipulate. There are brands obviously out there trying to manipulate you. But it's really a matter of making it easy for the consumer to truly understand what the product is all about, how it can benefit their lives. From a psychological perspective, if you can get that right, you can sell a lot more product to a lot more people. Now, I want to end off the episode like, Gilbert, you work with a lot of e-commerce businesses specifically. And because you work with a lot of, I would say, lead generation, like local businesses that need consumer-facing leads specifically. Gil, from your perspective, working mainly with, you know, or being more of an e-commerce expert, what would be your favorite tactics from a, if we would have to look at an e-commerce website, what would be some of your favorite tactics that you would include in your strategy or your sales process, whatever you want to call it, from an emotional and cognitive side of things? Like, what are the top three or four or five things that you would include if you had to build an online store, structure a web page or whatever it be?
First one is the riding on that bandwagon effect, ensuring that each and every product has a massive amount of customer reviews. Hopefully they're mainly positive ones. So ensuring that there's enough positive reviews. Yeah, I mean, look, it's not the end of the world if there's also negative reviews.
Actually, that can sometimes help.
Yes, and it definitely can. But for me, the one thing that would be was ensuring that there's customer reviews. Also, because the customer reviews, you must understand, they are what are validating that product. Okay? It's very easy for every brand to talk about how amazing their product is and how great it is and why it's so fast and ABC. But it's only when you really hear from the customer, that's when it becomes more authentic. Mm. And so I would be ensuring that, one, I have a great product so that people could actually review me. So that, in fact, I always say, like, the amount of reviews that you get, as authentic as they come through, what it really boils down to is they're a validation of how good your product is. If you don't even have to ask for a review, then you know you've got something very good, right? And if it was me, I would make sure, first and foremost, I've got a product that the market wants and it is indeed as good as I say it is, so that I don't even have to be asking for the reviews. People should just come flocking because they believe that this is a product that needs to be talked about and be given into other people's hands because it really solves the problem that it says it does. So first of all, having a great product so that you can ensure that you naturally get reviews, bandwagon effect. The second thing is, as an e-commerce store, is ensuring that the process is very simple. I talked about if you can have a website that people can essentially purchase a product in three steps or less, then you're going to increase your chances of those actions taking place. And the reason why, again, it's three steps or less is because people don't have the time and the energy to try and understand how to navigate your site. We get distracted. So if there's 10 steps versus three steps, I can easily get someone, Yandre all of a sudden comes talking to me while I'm trying to check out here, but I've got an additional step, but he's talking in my ear like, hey, we've got to do this. And I end up leaving it because there's too many steps to take, right?
You know what that makes me think of is the instant gratification bias as well, because the easier that you can make it for someone to actually go onto your product page and convert into a paying customer, the higher probability that you're going to get more sales, essentially, because, you know, if we think about conversion rate, now people coming to the site versus the amount of people that actually buy, if you can make it quick and easy, you are stimulating that instant gratification bias because people want things instantly. We just don't have the patience to wait. So when things get complicated, you know, there's again the availability heuristic, because all the information is available, I can make a decision. There's enough information available to make a decision. The bandwagon effect proves to me that the information is validated. And if the process is simple, then I'm stimulating my instant gratification bias.
And the third thing on that note is delivery. So imagine this, if you can deliver within 24 hours versus 3 days, 4 days, about instant gratification, 24 hours, what? I'm doing that. So that's the third thing in terms of what I would be aiming to achieve and employ in terms of tactics. And those three things I would say are very crucial. But of course, also just in terms of having risk removals, you know, 100% money back guarantee, for example, must understand consumers, especially if it's a brand they've never been on, they want to make sure that they're buying the right product. And we need to find ways of, because the logical side is going to kick in and say, look, yes, there's a lot of chatter and talk, positive reviews, and this is probably a product that is validated because of that. But what happens if you don't like it? What happens if you are unhappy with the product, regardless of all these things? Because that's where the logical side does kick in. So what's important is to also ensure that there are risk reversals that exist. And one simple one is just providing, let's say, a 60-day money-back guarantee if you're unhappy with the product. And that then moves the consumer into the next stage of validating and saying, yes, okay, you know what, this product is for me. I believe that this is the right solution and I'm going to end up purchasing. So having risk removals as well would help a lot in terms of getting a conversion and getting customers to purchase.
Well, I mean, that also stimulates the loss aversion.
Yes, the loss, yeah.
It's like really going, people don't want to lose. Mm-hmm. And they go, well, I'm going to lose my money if this product is not valuable. And you're giving them the opportunity of going, no, you're not going to lose that money if you're not happy with the product. So therefore, have a money back guarantee in some way, shape or form. So Vikas, on your end, working more with local businesses, would love to know some of the, you know, the tactics that, you know, you would suggest a local business includes from an emotional and logical standpoint that can help them convert more, you know, leads into customers.
Yeah. So for a local consumer brand or a lead generation brand direct to consumer, I would say trust and credibility is definitely up there. As Gilbert also mentioned, from the e-commerce side, you need reviews and you need proof that your product or your service actually works and actually gets the result that your advertising promises or that you promise to your customers. And then I would say also really important is urgency and scarcity in all of our adverts. Like, we religiously use that when we try to get people over the edge. Urgency and scarcity is also one of the most important things.
As long as it's authentic, essentially, and you can justify how authentic it is and why it's authentic.
Yeah, for sure. Like, authenticity and your urgency.
Can you give us some examples of authentic, you know, authentic scarcity or urgency in a strategy, for example? Is there anything that you can think of top of mind? That...
Yeah, I think from our side, what we do a lot is we would do like a treatment week for some of the beauty clinics that we work with. And for that week, we have certain treatments at a really good price. And that is a good strategy for getting people into your business as first-time customers who've never heard about you. And usually from there, the salons and clinics make a lot of upsells in terms of product. And then they make a lot of, usually they bring a friend back again, or they buy a course of treatments directly from that. So that's a really good strategy to just have like an intense week of, or just a week of where you have certain things at a really good price, or you can call it like a wellness week or whatever the case may be, or a skin rejuvenation week at your business. And that's a really good way to create some authentic urgency underneath people.
Yeah. And what I'm also hearing there is the halo effect of, like you mentioned, someone bringing a friend, because if you said, hey, you know, I've maybe been here before, I've had my nails done here, or I had my treatment done here, you know, let me bring you with me next time when I'm going for a spa treatment. That is someone going, yeah, okay, cool, let me tag along, let me give this a shot.
I was going to say, I can imagine maybe another example as well of authenticity is, say, for example, you're a coach, you host seminars every month, but you only have 10 spots. And there's a reason why you only have 10 spots is because, well, one, there's only one of you. And you want to make sure that each and every individual there is given the same amount of attention that, you know, anybody else would want and expect from you. And you want to make sure that you're giving them the most amount of value and attention. But because there's only one of you, you can only do this really successfully with a group of 10 to make it as intimate as possible. And, you know, you find yourself having a page where people are signing up possibly to the seminar, and they're going to start seeing only 3 spots left, only 2 spots left. But it's purely because you can only take a certain amount of people so that they have the full experience and they truly feel like it was a valuable experience for that given month. So I think that might be an example of authenticity and being able to, you know, show that that's 2 spots or 1 spot left.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what we do at VA Media as well. It's like we can only onboard, or we can only have so many clients because we only have so much staff. So it's like, hey, you know, we've got 2 spots open, or we've got 3 spots open. You know, if you want to jump on board, here's the story. Like, we've got a client who's being onboarded, then we've got 1 spot or 2 spots left this month. Like, it's real because of the fact that we only have so many hands available. So in people pick up on that. They can also pick up when you're lying and when you're being fake about it, but it's really going like, hey, listen, we want to get you started. We've got 1 or 2 spots left. If you're still keen, come on board. If not, let's talk about this 2-3 months from now. But then again, it's the loss aversion of the price, because then we go, well, we can't guarantee that we're going to give you the exact same price, because we've had people who come back a year later expecting the same price. And we're like, but we told you, we can't give you that price. So, I mean, these are just some of our tactics. And I think one of my favorite strategies, I don't really want to call it a strategy, because I think it just speaks to me as a human being and to us sitting here, is like just being truthful and honest. And whoever you're servicing on the other side, being truthful and honest to that person, whether you can actually help them or not. And that immediately creates that trust and credibility effect, where someone then, because we kind of like are a bit of an authority in our space. So we have that authority effect, but then also that gets amplified with that trust and credibility side of it, where because we have authority doesn't mean we can manipulate people into taking our services. You know, that's not necessarily going to work. So it's understanding that we now, because we have authority, you know, whether it's me or Gilbert or someone jumping on a call or whatever it may be, you know, it's our job to be authentic about whether we can truly help this person or not. And if we can't, we, you know, say that all the time. And in essence, if we can, you know, here's why. You know, here's an undeniable stack of proof to show you that we've gotten it right from many other people just like yourself. But again, there's no guarantee. So, but yeah, I think from my side, yeah, your tactics, thanks for that, Gil. That's very interesting, Vikas, and really appreciated having this talk. Really understanding that the brain works in 2 different ways, and it's really important for us to understand that. And if we can implement this into our marketing strategies and tactics, you know, we will be seeing a, you know, bigger success, you know, when it comes to selling our products or services. Now, that is all from my side for our second episode. I hope that you on the other end enjoyed that. There was some value in it for you. Gil, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Vix, thanks to you.
Nice to be here.
All the best, everybody. We'll see you guys next week.